Okay, good afternoon everyone, we'll make a start. Obviously you know what you're here to see, maybe you don't know what you're going to see, but you'll find out. Two speakers today, we've got Peter Mulquinney and Hugh Miller. Peter's a fellow of the Institute, works for Taylor Fry, and has been a consultant in GI and sort of accident comp areas for almost 10 years. He's got a wide range of GI experience from workers' comp valuations to domestic lines pricing and price optimisation. Peter's also got a PhD in biochemistry from the Uni of Sydney and previously worked as a research fellow at the University of Oxford. And at Oxford, he developed computer models of the heart in order to identify suitable patients for drug therapy. So a little bit different. Hugh's been a member of Taylor Fry since 2006 and in that time's undertaken a range of work, particularly in general insurance valuations and pricing. He's a core part and certainly is a core part of our, Taylor Fry's analytics division and undertaken data intensive analysis work for government insurance companies and telcos. Hugh also has a PhD and undertakes a lot of research. His recent paper on inflation assumptions presented to the 2010 GI seminar was awarded the 2011 A.M. Parker Prize for the best paper published. And he says here that he loves his two young children and he used to love a good night's sleep. So before I hand over to Peter, just a couple of things. Please feel free to tweet if that's your thing. Remember, there's the app, so we do want feedback. And if there's time for... Do you want questions on the way through? You happy with that or prefer at the end?
Maybe at the end.
Okay, so questions at the end, and there's a microphone there and name, rank, serial number, and we'll go from there. So over to Peter.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. And thank you for coming to our talk on a topic of interest, how to extrapolate the yield curve. I'll be presenting the first half of the talk and my colleague Hugh Miller will be presenting the second half. So if you're finding me hard going, please stick around because he's a much better speaker than I am. So the best is yet to come. Also, I'd like to give a plug. We've written a paper which goes alongside the presentation. So if there's anything you don't understand or you find things interesting, you'll find a lot more detail in the paper. So please have a look at that. And also, if you're at last year's General Insurance Conference and you've come along and you thought, I saw this paper there and come along expecting to see something new, well, you won't. It's exactly the same paper that we presented at that conference and we've been asked to present it again. So again, I won't be offended if you leave now if you've seen it all before. Okay, so the topic for today's talk is extrapolation of yield curve. So as actuaries, you would all be aware of the use of yield curve in discounting liabilities. And for APRA valuations, at least, the yield curve of interest is that from Commonwealth government bonds. Now, an issue occurs when you're valuing very long-tailed liabilities. So if your liability has payments which come at the current time, say more than 15 years in the future, then the yield curve will only extend to about 15 years, the last dated Commonwealth government bonds out at the moment are about 15 years into the future. So if that's the case, you need to extrapolate the yield curve. And I'd like to talk about some of the technical issues around that today. Okay, so there are really only three main issues for yield curve extrapolation, and they're identified on this slide here. So the first issue is basically where we start our extrapolation from. So if the blue curve here represents your known yield curve, so the yield curve you can estimate, where should you start the extrapolation from? Should you start from the very end point? Or maybe we can't estimate that very reliably. Maybe we should step back a little bit and start our estimation where we know the yield curve a little bit more accurately. So the first question is, where do we start our extrapolation from? So having decided that, the next question is, where do you extrapolate to? So in this diagram here, we're extrapolating up to some point around here, which we've called the unconditional forward rate. So that's I guess, the second question, where you extrapolate to. So one option is you could just extrapolate flat, or you could extrapolate to some long-term mean reversion level. And then the third question is, how do you get there? So what path do you take and how quickly do you get there? And they're the topics I'll talk about today. But before I do that, I'd like to consider very, very briefly just some of the philosophical and regulatory considerations around yield curve extrapolation. And the reason for doing that is that those considerations will affect what your solutions to the technical problems. So very broadly speaking, there are two main philosophical approaches to yield curve extrapolation. The first one has an emphasis on market consistency at a point in time. So when you extrapolate under this philosophy, the idea is to try and work out what the prices of very long-term Commonwealth government bonds would be. So this is like 20-year, 30-year, 50-year bonds if they actually existed. So if they were existed and actively traded. And that would be the aim of a market-consistent extrapolation. The second approach has more emphasis on liability stability. So people who prefer this approach, emphasise the fluctuation in liability values that you can have when you use a market-consistent approach. And I think that fluctuation is not helpful for the management of the business, and therefore something which emphasises stability is a better approach. So proponents of the second approach might be happy about a market-consistent approach for the known part of the yield curve, but where you don't know the yield curve and you have to make some guess or some extrapolation, why choose an approach which leads to more volatility than necessary? So they're a broad characterisation of the two main approaches. You could spend a whole hour or two discussing the pros and cons of both, and I'm not going to do that here. But instead, I'll just look to what the regulatory environment suggests the approach we need to take is. So when I prepared these slides, I were prepared for a general insurance seminar. So I'm not going to go into detail about the general insurance standards and prudential regulations. I'll just make the point that for both life insurance and also for general insurance, valuations which are done under APRA standards should have a market-consistent approach. So that's the approach that is recommended by APRA or required by APRA. And that's the approach that I'll take for yield curve extrapolation today. Okay, so on to the first question. So what is the longest market forward rate that we can actually estimate reliability? So this is a question of where do we start our extrapolation from? So to answer this question, what we did was try and work out what the estimation error in the forward rate curve or the forward rate yield curve was. And on this diagram, I've got two yield curves, one from the end of 2011 and one from the middle of 2012. And on both of them, there are three lines. So the centre line on both represents our estimated yield curve. And the top and bottom lines, the dashed lines, represent a 90% confidence interval on that yield curve. And I guess the striking thing about both yield curves is that the confidence intervals are relatively tight for most of the curve, until you get to the end, so the last 2 to 3 years, the estimation error starts to increase. So for most of the curve, the width of the confidence interval is about 10 to 15 basis points. By about year 13, the width is about 25. And by year 15, that's the last dated government bond that we had at the time, the width is out to 40 basis points. So knowing that you've got a lot of error out here, why place undue emphasis on these last estimated yield curve points? It probably makes sense to actually step back a couple of years to where you know the yield curve with more certainty and start your extrapolation from there. A related point is, here we can see that it looks like the yield curve is flattening out, but that could be an artifact of how I'm fitting it. Why flatten it out if that's not really the case, and we can't estimate that with accuracy. So this just summarises what I've just said. And so at the moment, where the longest dated bond is about 15 years long, it appears reasonable to start extrapolations about terms of about 13 years. Okay, now onto the second question. So having decided where to start the extrapolation, where should we extrapolate to? And for the purpose of this presentation, we've called that level that we extrapolate to, the unconditional forward interest rate. So this is the idea of some interest rate a very long time in the future, say 100 years in the future, 50 years in the future, where we will revert to over time. So there is a question about whether that's sensible. Are forward rates mean reverting? I guess that's a question we'll be looking at. So in terms of deciding that you should mean revert, for us at least, it seems like a reasonable starting point, because if you can't estimate the last point on your yield curve very well and your yield curve is still rising at the end or still decreasing at the end, if you're going to perform an extrapolation, it needs to go somewhere. So you have to make a decision about where it's going to go, and that's what we're trying to do here. So in terms of deciding what this ultimate or unconditional forward rate should be, economic considerations suggest there are probably three main components that we'll need to estimate to come up with it. The first two components, these two, are really just the expected future short-term interest rate, the nominal interest rate, which has two components, expected future inflation and expected real short-term interest rate. So these are expected values a long time into the future. And the final component is term premia. And it's actually the most difficult thing to estimate, and that's what makes coming up with an ultimate forward rate a difficult thing to do, and that's what I'll spend most time on today. So what is a term premia? So term premia is a difference between your forward rate and expected short-term interest rates. So another way of thinking about that, or another way of saying that, is forward rates do not necessarily only represent expectations about future short-term interest rates, and the difference between the two is called the term premium. And there are a number of components which make up term premia. Some of them act to make term premia positive, and some of them act to make term premia negative, and the balance of them kind of depends on whether they'll be a positive or negative value. So the three components that we've identified are risk premia. And that's the idea that if your investors are going to invest in long-term bonds, they want extra reward for taking on the extra interest rate volatility that you experience by investing long. So you're exposed to greater mark-to-market losses if you invest long. So some investors will demand a higher risk premium to do that. The second component is referred to as term preference. And this acts in the other opposite direction to risk premia. Term preference occurs when you have institutional investors like life insurers and pension funds who have very long-term liabilities and need to invest in assets which match the term of those liabilities. Their demand can act to actually drive the price of bonds up and hence drive yields down and term premia down. And the third effect are convexity effects. It's a technical effect which I won't go into here, but it's to do with the interest rate convexity of bonds and that actually acts to lower yields as well. So it acts to bring down term premia a little bit as well. So the thing which makes term premia very difficult to measure and to estimate is the fact that they have very strong time varying behaviour. And this is an illustration of that. And this study comes from a study from US bonds. There's been similar studies done on Australian bonds as well, but the data for the US was better, so I've presented that here. And what this study shows is essentially a breakdown of the forward rate, which is the blue line here, so this is your yield curve forward rate, and it's broken down into two components. The first component is being expected short-term interest rates, and the second component is the term premium. So we have this breakdown at different points along the yield curve. So the first point is for 1 year forward rates, the middle graph is for 5 year forward rates, and the last graph is for 10 year forward rates. So in terms of extrapolation, there are two really interesting things to take from this graph. The first is, if we focus on expected short-term rates, so the green line, you'll see that as we go across in term, so we go from 1 year forward rates to 10 year, there appears to be mean reversion. So we have lots of volatility and fluctuation in the short-term forward rates, but by year 10, that's settled down a lot. So expectations about future interest rates are mean reverting. So the idea of having a mean reverting ultimate expected short-term interest rate is quite a reasonable one to have. The problem, though, is the term premium. And you can see that they're fluctuating quite widely, so we're having swings of almost up to 2% on a monthly basis. And those swings are still, it's hard to say from this graph, but they look pretty much as strong as they are at 5 years. So it's difficult to say whether you're having mean reversion in the term premium. So if they're not mean reverting, how do you come up with an ultimate rate for them, particularly given they're so hard to measure? And what Hugh will talk about later is some evidence which suggests that term premium are mean reverting, and the concept of an unconditional forward rate is not a bad one. So this is our suggested unconditional forward rate. It's got the components I talked about earlier, the two main ones being expected future short-term interest rates and term premium. I won't go into the details here. If you're interested in how we come up with this, you can go to the paper. But the main comment I'll make is that our ultimate rate of 5.8% is probably a little bit more optimistic than the experience of 10-year bond rates since the 90s. So it's consistent, but a little bit more optimistic. So that's all I'd like to say on that, and I'd like to hand over to Hugh now.
Thanks, Peter, and good afternoon, everybody. All right, so Peter's done all the hard work, so he's contextualised and answered two of the questions. So I'll spend the rest of the time talking about just this one question, really. So how quickly should we return to the unconditional forward rate, which for the time being we'll assume exists? And I'm going to do that in two ways. So firstly, we'll look at the international evidence, and secondly, we'll look at some Australian data and what you can tease out of that. So here's a graph that's similar to one of the ones we had earlier, and this is the context in which we're working here. So we have a blue line, which is our known yield curve from observable Commonwealth bonds. We have an unconditional forward rate of 5.8% that we want to sort of tend to over some period of time, and the main question is how quickly should we do that? So that's that capital T there. And there is quite a lot of variation that we've seen in actuarial practice, in Australia at least, which is one of, the motivations for looking at this as a research paper. So as I mentioned, the first thing we're going to look at is the international evidence. So there are longer dated bonds in a number of other countries, and these run up to sort of 30 years and even beyond that. And we've collected data for three countries, the UK, USA and Canada. The reason why we chose those is firstly they speak English, so the websites are a little bit easier to navigate. And secondly, the people at the Reserve Bank had actually done all the hard work of decomposing, extracting forward rates from the bond price histories for us. And so we sort of used their work in that. Which was nice. So this data actually gives us quite a lot of information about how the yield curve behaves. So we are able to look at these long histories of forward rates and how they changed. We've used data since 1998, and the reason we chose that year is that's sort of the clear point in time when inflation expectations were reasonably stable. So we don't have to try and sort of back out how inflation expectations are changing. So that's when the genie was bottled, as they say. So our first analysis of this data was a regression-based approach. So I've written up a linear equation there, so you can all feel good about knowing what a linear equation is. So we've modelled the forward rate at time S plus T as just a straight linear function of the forward rate at time S. So that's what F of S stands for. And in that linear equation, you've got a constant term, that's the alpha, and that relates to expected rates and term premia, and that's actually of lesser interest to us in this particular context. And there's a slope coefficient, beta. And that slope coefficient is more important in this context because it gives us an indication of how much the forward rate at S plus T is moving up and down relative to the forward rate at time S. So as an example, if we regress the 20-year forward rate against the 10-year forward rate on the UK data set, we get a regression equation F20 equals 0.78% plus 0.74 F of 10. And that's basically saying for every 1% increase in the 10-year forward rate, on average over that period of time, we tended to see a 0.74% increase in the 20-year forward rate. So that's actually reasonably good evidence that the 20-year forward rate is not the unconditional forward rate, because it has quite a heavy dependence on what is happening earlier on the left-hand side of the yield curve. So what you can then do is you can then change the S&T that you're using in the regression. So what I'm going to show here is where we fixed S at 10 years and we regress different forward rates against that. So if you read off 20 off the x-axis, that's the example we just looked at, where you can see the slope coefficient equaled 0.74. But you can change that value of t, and you can see how that slope coefficient varies. And this is quite an interesting result, as you can see here. Firstly, for the UK data, it's the coefficient, the slope coefficient, is close to 1 for 5 years. And that's basically telling us that as the 10-year forward rate moves up, the 15-year forward rate tends to move up and down in lockstep. So no evidence of sort of drifting towards the unconditional forward rate by then. But we do have a slow decay in the slope parameter from there in something that looks a little bit like a straight line. And this is some of my best work here. I've fitted a straight line to the straight line and concluded that the line is about straight. And you can see even at 25 years, the forward rate, the slope coefficient is still 0.5, so it's saying we've actually still got a way to go before the forward rate in the long bit of the tail is independent of the 10-year forward rate. So that's some evidence of a fairly slow reversion. So here's the same graph but for US data, and you can see sort of slightly different but similar in underlying substance. So the decay seems to start right away, so you get a bit of a linear decay right from year 10, but that decay seems to be a lot slower in the case of the US. And if you extrapolate that line out, it doesn't really hit zero until year 80, which sort of suggests a very, very slow reversion to the unconditional forward rate. Here's the results for Canada, and something a little bit weird's going on. I fitted a straight line to it just for the hell of it, but if you're an academic, you're supposed to say for the sake of completeness. So I fitted a straight line for the sake of completeness. So a little bit harder to interpret results, but you can see that even at year 30, the slope coefficient is 0.5, so there's still not much evidence. The evidence seems to be that you need to converge to your unconditional forward rate at a number higher than 30 duration. Here's a table summarising those results. So where the duration decay seems to begin for each of those countries. And I've extrapolated those dotted lines and basically sort of determined where they hit zero. And that can be sort of a proxy estimate for the time at which we reach the UFR. We've put confidence intervals around that, so we've done a little bootstrap thing to try and figure out what the uncertainty is there. And you can see that there's a reasonable difference between the three countries, and there's a reasonable amount of uncertainty. But even if you choose sort of the lower bound of the lowest, you're still looking at 31 years. That's the UK example there, which is relatively slow decay, I guess. We did do a second type of analysis using the same data called printable components analysis. The idea behind printable components analysis is you're trying to capture as much variation as possible in your system by a single shape. So if you haven't come across it before, it's quite a nice technique. There's a nice little write-up at the end of the paper about it. I probably shouldn't say it's nice, I wrote it. But there's a little write-up. So probably worth your time because it's quite powerful in a number of contexts. But in the case of the yield curve, what you can do is run principal components analysis on the history, and that will give you the shape that the yield curve tends to move most often, which is quite a powerful thing. So how does the yield curve tend to move away from its average shape? And you can actually look at the shape and see how fixed the tail is relative to the rest, and that gives some evidence as to how quickly you're converging to sort of a fixed point or an unconditional forward rate. To sort of explain that again using a picture, if you run principal components analysis, you get a leading principal component. If that principal component is something like the blue line, so flat, that tells you that the yield curve is primarily moving by parallel shift, so that everything moves up 1% or everything moves down 1% on average. If you get something more like the dotted orange line, that's telling you that you're getting something that has something fixed on the right-hand side and parallel shift on the left-hand side. And so that would be considered good evidence that you've reached the unconditional forward rate at E25, because that tends to remain fixed while the rest of the yield curve moves. And you, in addition to sort of leading principal components, you get secondary and third principal components, and these explain the other types of shifts that you see in the yield curve after you allow for the first one. So we ran this on the data again, and here's the result for the Canadian yield curve. I remember this was the one that behaved poorly before, and it actually behaves quite well under the principal components analysis. The blue line is the first principal component. It explains 80% of all variation in the yield curve over that time period. And you can see it's virtually flat. So that's strong evidence that it's tending to move by parallel shift. If you squint really hard, you can see it's sort of dipping at the right-hand side. That dip is statistically significant, so I guess it is real. And that's sort of showing some movement towards perhaps a fixed rate out there somewhere. So you could probably, well, what we have done is we've taken that right-hand portion and extrapolated a line and used that to get an estimate of where we hit the unconditional forward rate there. So here are the results for the US. Again, very, very flat, with a little bit of a tilt towards the right-hand side. And you can see all these other printable components moving around. So, but once again, the first printable component explained by far and away most of the variation in the yield curve. This is the result for the UK yield curve, and the UK is the bad, or the slightly confusing performer in this type of analysis. You can see that quite strong effects have actually happened in the UK yield curve on the left-hand side, so duration 0 to 10, and you can sort of see that clearly in the data. But if you remind yourselves that we're most interested in projecting from duration 10 onwards, again we see a pattern of fairly flat, so tending to move up and down together, with a little bit of decay towards the right-hand side. So we use this to get some estimates. So this is a table very similar to what we had before. The numbers tend to be a little bit bigger than what we got using the regression analysis. Probably fair to say we haven't completely reconciled the two sets of estimates. Suffice to say they are just different types of analysis, so in some ways you would expect them to give slightly different answers. In terms of summing up all that international evidence, we think a reversion occurring somewhere between duration 40 and duration 100 is plausible, and so our magic number, just because people like picking a specific number, is 60 in that range, seems to be a reasonable duration at which you can hit that constant unconditional forward rate. And the main observation from this is that this is a fairly slow reversion, so we're not reverting in 20 years or 25 years. The evidence seems to be that you should be using a number larger than that for market consistency. The last thing I wanted to talk about is heading back to Australian data. And I'm going to sort of talk about a reversion to the unconditional forward rate with reference to hedging strategies. So something no one ever told me during my actuarial education is that there are ways of doing duration matching hedging strategies, even if you've got a liability that sits beyond your longest dated bond. So the way you do that is you short sell a short-term bond and you go long a long-term bond, and the calculated duration then actually has a value greater than the longer-term bond. So that way you can actually do some duration matching, so a type of immunisation, although the convexity is working against you in that particular case. I struggle to find a reference for this, but I can't be the first person who's ever thought of it. So if you have seen it before, please let me know and we'll try and improve the paper. But one thing that this hedging strategy requires is you do actually have to extrapolate the yield curve out to when your liability falls due, because you need to know its present value. And because you need to do that, you can actually use this sort of hedging approach as a way of testing whether certain extrapolations work better than others. So you can actually sort of run this as a hedging, choose a particular extrapolation technique and see how that hedging performs. So here's our little simulation we've done using Australia data. So it's fairly simple. Suppose we have $100 that we have to pay someone in 20 years, and suppose we have 4-year bonds and 10-year zero coupon bonds that we can invest in, and every quarter we rebalance. So we sell our position and there are new zero coupon 4-year and 10-year bonds that we can reinvest in. So we'll go short in the 4-year, long in the 10-year, and that will hopefully allow us to get a duration that matches our liability. And that liability will sort of shrink in its duration until we sort of hedge for 10 years, at which point the liability will be due in 10 years and we can just close out our position using a 10-year zero coupon bond. So then we can basically track our hedging performance over time. And I've done that using two extrapolations of the yield curve. So one that's a fast UFR assumption where we assume the unconditional forward rate return is achieved at time duration 20, so a linear shape between 10 and 20. And I've also used a long reversion, which is basically a constant for the purposes of this experiment. Let's see how they go. So this is the hedging performance starting at June 1995. And you can see using a slow reversion assumption is the blue line. We basically hedge our liability very, very well. So we're sort of within $2 all the time, and just by complete fluke, it manages to end up $100, which is pretty good result. The green line, which assumes a faster reversion to the unconditional forward rate, seems to not perform as well. In a sense, it performs better because you make $5 or $6, but that's not the purpose of a hedging strategy. So we would use this as evidence of saying the slow reversion in this sort of hedging scenario seems to work better. So we've done it on a number of different years. We claim that in all cases, the slow reversion works better. The one you might ask me about later is the June 2000, which I still think the blue line's better. I got some sniggers, so I should explain. Even though the green line finishes closer to the orange line, you can see that they both perform pretty poorly over the first 4 or 5 years. But if you then rebalance at that point, the blue line is actually more stable. And so that's sort of my slightly weak argument why I prefer the blue line there, whereas the green line is wrong twice, but manages to cancel itself out. So our conclusion out of this hedging analysis is that the slow reversion assumption seems to work better, and I interpret that to be some evidence that a slow reversion assumption is superior to a fast one. The hedging, more of an aside, I guess, the hedging strategy actually performs quite well, which was a surprise. So typically, you'll tend to be within 1% of what you were trying to achieve. And that's a way of actually hedging a 20-year liability, even when you don't have 20-year bonds available, which is pretty cool. And the observation is that if you just invested in the long-term bond, so the 10-year bond, your performance would be much, much worse than even the fast reversion assumption. So that's it in terms of our analysis and what we've done. So there are a couple of slides here just summarising what we've done. So the yield curve is good up until about 2 years from the end, at which point the estimation error grows quite rapidly. So those were the graphs that Peter was showing at the beginning of the talk. So that sort of longest dated bond minus 2 years seems to be a good starting point for any extrapolation you want to do. There's reasonable evidence of slow reversion to some sort of unconditional forward rate. We've provided an estimate of what we think that unconditional forward rate could be, and 60 is our magic number. But anything beyond 40 would seem reasonable in terms of when you reach that rate. We've used linear paths, so everywhere in our paper. There's no particular reason why we've done that, except that some of the curves looked fairly straight, and I struggle with anything that's harder than linear. So that's where we've started. There are other papers out there that look at different spline things, and certainly that seems fairly legitimate. And the other comment was that this long-term hedging strategy seems to be possible, and seems to favour the fact that the slow reversion is more market consistent. Our final comment, so something Peter, I guess, sort of skipped over a little bit in his contextualisation, is that the Australian standards aren't completely clear about the extrapolation issue, and I know there's been some other work by the GIPC in terms of thinking through what that means and whether changes should be made. And Peter also mentioned that there is this tension then, if a slow reversion assumption means you move to that forward rate very slowly, then and that's what you have to do if you want to be market consistent, then that actually has sort of potential implications for a more volatile liability. And so there's, a philosophical question there. The other comment I made is that if you've watched Joe Hockey's comments, he's quite interested in establishing longer-term bonds in Australia, so 30 or 50 years, which means, given the current opinion polls, this paper probably has a shelf life of a year or two. So get in while it's good. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Hugh. Peter, we've got about 13 minutes for questions, so anyone with questions, please, get up and state your name, please, and then off you go.
Hi. Thanks both for the paper. My name's Michael Hermy. I'm from KPMG, but I guess some of my comments come from my role chairing the Industry Disadvantage Task Force, across practice, a task force. Looking at risk-free discount rates, most recently looking at the issue you've been looking at in terms of extrapolation of the Commonwealth Government bond yield curve for the purposes of capital calculations under the new APRA capital standards. So I thought it was a very thought-provoking paper. I think it really helps inform some of the debate. And that information that task force did actually includes at a high level of one of the methods you've got. So it refers to as an economic long-term rate. So, and I'm sure a lot of people will be using an economic long-term rate and extrapolating it to it somehow when doing the calculations under the new applicable standards. I guess some of my main points would be around information that it talks about being aware of other market data, such as swap curves, and how they trend following that 15-year period where government bonds are no longer available. Even today, there was a lot of talk around longevity and presentations around the issuing of overseas bonds, longer-term bonds, cross-currency hedging, getting it back to a rate. Now, these issues are very important. We've had issues in the past with clients, and particularly around that 15 to 40-year period for annuities, par books, where people are looking at a swap curve, and actually, and I know there's some comments around how liquid it is and concerns around it, but the reality is, when they speak to their investment banks and actually try and, from a practical perspective, manage their books and hedge out that liability, and they're looking at a swap curve in the past, which has sometimes been below the forwards on government bond yields, I mean, that's a real issue, particularly when we're talking about yields used for capital calculations. So I'm interested in your thoughts around how you bring that in, and also I can see we've got people here from Challenger and other annuity providers around managing that, and that, you know, the last thing you want to do is use a discount rate for valuations of capital, which is higher than the one you're locking in from a real perspective. So that's probably my main point around that. I think there are probably some other points that hope you could chance to get your thoughts and other people's chance to speak as well.
Yeah, I probably don't have much of real value to add what you have said, except that the motivation for what we did came from, I guess, challenging some of the practice in general insurance, where looking at other instruments apart from Commonwealth Government bonds just wasn't on the table, and people were either extrapolating just at a constant level or extrapolating in a 5-year period, and we wanted to test whether that was a reasonable thing to do, and the evidence seemed to suggest otherwise. In terms of making reference to other instruments, it's something I haven't I don't know much about, so I'm really out of my depth, but my understanding is that the market is not very well developed in this country for terms beyond 15 years, so I'm happy, I'd be interested to hear about what the market is like beyond that 15 years. I think in the UK swap rates way out into the future are very deep and liquid, but I'm unsure about the Australian market. So if anyone's got anything to add there, that would be very helpful. But certainly the APRA standards talk a lot about when you come to extrapolation, making reference to alternative instruments as a starting point. It's just with our experience and our line of work, we don't come across those instruments, so we're not really aware of them.
So. Yeah, the only other comment I'll add is that we were very happy when the long-term interest rate paper came out, information note, and our recommendation sort of fitted into it rather than contradicted it. It was a bit of a relief. So.
Surely someone else has got a question.
The way it was done is that the actual yield curve itself was estimated using called the Merrill Lynch exponential smoothing spline technique. So it's one that the RBA uses in Australia. So that was our initial fit, and then we in that fit, the fit's not perfect. Some of the bond prices are above and below what you estimate them to be. They were taken as the error, and we used the bootstrap technique to recast the data. And did that, I think it was 1,000 times. So I was using a bootstrap technique and I think those confidence intervals will change with the technique and the method that you use. So we used a commonly used one. If we had have used a smoothing spline method, I think we would have got the same issue. With some parametric methods, we may have been able to constrain the end a bit, but then you're making stronger assumptions about the shape then. So, it's just illustrative that you don't know too much about that end of the curve. You either have to make some strong assumptions that you presuppose, and if you don't make those strong assumptions, you get a lot of estimation error in the tail.
Anybody else? No. Stability was mentioned. You've presumably used this method a couple of times now in an environment where interest rates have fluctuated a fair bit. How has that impacted the valuation? How stable has it been?
In my line of work, where I use this is in workers' compensation valuations. So... it won't have had much influence on my liabilities. So I guess the approaches we tended to use always had a fairly flat. They either were projected at a level, so no reversion, or there's been. So I'm confusing myself because what I use in practice is actually a mixture of a number of techniques. So. If I had have used this method, it wouldn't have had much difference on what I've done. But if others in my area had used it, it would made a big difference to their valuation. So those who make very fast reversion assumptions to some constant level, they would notice a lot more volatility in their liabilities than if they use this method.
We've got a few minutes, so if there is another question, we'll take it. And if not, then I'll get you to join me in thanking Peter and Hugh.